Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Just to update you where we are, the folks in the department that were going to offer testimony on 1286 are still over in the other body testifying, although I have gotten some advice on the bill. I think I can at least present it, and if the committee is uncomfortable after that in passing it, we can wait till they show up. But I understand the folks that are going to be the resources for Senator Newman's bill are on their way, so I thought we would try to deal with 1286 right now and then deal with Senator Newman's bill. But Senate File 1286, and this morning when we heard testimony on a bill that referred to the changes in the federal laws with respect to case mix classification, and they were talking about a system that was called RUG 3, which is an acronym that stands for
Resource Utilization Groups.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Higgins. So what has happened, and I've got a little write-up from the Department of Health, the federal government has changed the resource utilization group structure from 36 to 48 groups. And so as a consequence of that, there is a assessment tool called the Minimum Data Set, MDS, and we're currently using 2.0. But in order to handle the new group classifications under RUG 4, they need to go to MDS 3.0. And so what this bill is doing is simply making the changes in our statutes to reflect that we are going to be using that new assessment product and the new RUG groupings. I believe I have that correct. And I have some advice over here from the department that says that's what this bill is doing. So without the further technical assistance of the department, I would be willing to try to answer any questions that the committee has on this. I think it is not controversial. I think it is an attempt to make our systems comply with the changes that the federal government is implementing so that we can continue to do the assessments that we need to do. Just reading the little sheet that the department has provided, I think it does address some of the existing problems that have been brought up under the current RUGS 3 system. And so I don't believe there's anything controversial in the bill. I think it's just conforming to new federal expectations.
Senator Hamm, does council have any feedback, anything in this too? Are there any questions? Okay. Any questions, Senator Newman? No? So the minimum data set is going up to 3.0, and it was 2.0. So we're just doing a federal conformity on that.
Right. I think it's related to this change in the resource utilization group structure, and so that I think it requires a different assessment tool that is this 3.0.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe it's the other way around, that the minimum data set has been updated, and then we need to do the RUG 4 to comply with the minimum data set. Is that?
Okay.
I believe it's
essentially that could be. Madam Chair, Mr. Lobeko, I'm looking at this handout here. I think you are correct that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid System, CMS, Federal Center recently updated MDS 2.0 to an MDS 3.0 version and also has developed an updated version of RUGS called RUGS 4. So I think you're right. I think the MDS structure was changed and then the classifications were created to conform to that.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, is this being just laid over for possible inclusion?
Well, Senator we've been trying to take all the, Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, we've been trying to deal with these department bills as standalone bills and sending them to the floor.
Okay.
Unless they have to go to judiciary first. And I'm assuming this one does not.
I don't believe that this one has to.
I think that's what they're doing in the other body as well, that the omnibus bill is being reserved just for non-department bills, but just policy bills.
Senator Hahn, can you explain what the MDS is? I know it's a minimum data set, but what exactly does that do? Can anybody help me with that?
Well, what I have here is that each facility conducts an assessment of every resident
using a required federal assessment tool called the minimum data set. Apparently, in the assessment of people in nursing homes, they use this federal assessment, and it's called the minimum data set. I'm not familiar with it, but that's what they use to do the assessment. And then the federal government has changed that to a newer version that reflects, as they say, reflects the changing nursing home populations and needs. So they've changed their assessment. They're now asking us to conform. And then the RUGS 4 system, it says, brings a solution to a problem often complained about by private pay residents under the new RUGS 4 system. The treatments provided during a hospital stay preceding the nursing home admission will not be reflected in the nursing home care assessment, which often raised costs. So apparently they've tried to deal with an issue that has been a complaint. Case mix review section in the Compliance Monitoring Division of the Minnesota Department of Health performs audits of MDS assessments submitted by nursing homes every year, conducts reconsiderations of audits when requested. So what the bill is doing is simply taking those changes in federal structure and making conforming language in the law.
Yeah.
As I said, I don't believe it's controversial.
Great. Any other questions from the committee? I believe this is the committee. Maybe Senator Hall is coming, but I believe Senator Berglund is.
Senator Hall is over
here. Oh, Senator Hall is over there. But I believe we've lost everybody else. So.
Well, then we better move the bill quickly before we lose
before
everybody.
Before we start dropping. And Senator Hahn, as you said, I think this is to comply to the federal requirements. So your preference.
Madam Chair and members, I would move Senate File 1286 be recommended, passed, and referred to the floor.
Any other further questions on this bill? All those in favor of Senator Hahn's motion,
aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
We'll have lots of questions for him on the floor, I'm sure. Thank you.
Whoever wants to come
All right, Senator Newman, after playing some musical chairs here, we're back. Well, Senator Nino's back. Which bill are we taking up here?
You don't need a 13.
Which bill is it? 1285. Here it is.
Okay. Senator Newman, I think we're going to take up 1285, if I can find.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And before we begin on the bill, I do have an amendment. Which would be the A2 amendment. Council had provided me with a copy of it just before the committee hearing, in which some technical changes had been made, and so I would at this time offer the A2 amendment in order to get the bill in proper form.
Senator Newman moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? A2 amendment is adopted, and Senator Newman, the bill is now in the form that you wish. And did you want to make some comments, or do you want to turn it over to
yeah,
the...
Yeah, very briefly, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that I will tell you I received yesterday afternoon, and I will tell you I've done my best to go through it and read it. I am going to rely quite heavily on the committee. I have outlined some areas as we go through the bill that I'm going to want to ask the testifiers questions of. This is an agency bill, and there are four members from the agency that are here to help us work our way through the bill. And My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, would be to simply just move through the bill section by section. And with that, and there may be times when I'm going to interrupt and ask some questions. But with that, I would stand aside and simply let the DHS present their bill.
Thank you. And please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Thomas Reuter. I'm the Manager of Legislative and Stakeholder Relations for the Chemical and Mental Health Administration with the Department of Human Services. I have with me today three supervisors who are also with the Department of Human Services who would be able to answer more specific questions. Mr. Chair, if you wish, I could do a broad overview of the bill, and then we could do walk through it section by section as Senator Newman requested.
Mr. Reuter, that would be helpful if you could give us just maybe a brief summary, an overview of what the bill is going to do, and then we'll look at each section.
Okay. Mr. Chair, this bill is really is aligning our operating statutes for the Chemical and Mental Health Administration with the legislative direction that was set during the 2009 and 2010 legislative sessions. During the 2010 legislative session, the legislature adopted language that directed the commissioner to establish three payment tiers for mental health diagnostic assessment. The three tiers allow for greater flexibility in the use of diagnostic assessment at admission for outpatient mental health services. Additional technical amendments to Minnesota statutes are necessary to create consistency with the previously enabling legislation and the newly revised Rule 47. In addition, there are changes that were that are contained within the bill that were made as recommendations that came from the Chemical and Mental Health Services Advisory Task Force. The task force was created in 2010 and was charged to make recommendations to the Commissioner of Human Services and the legislature on the continuum of services needed to provide individuals with complex conditions, including mental illness, chemical dependency, traumatic brain injury, and developmental disabilities, access to quality care and appropriate levels of care across the state to promote wellness, reduce costs, and improve efficiency. The task force was convened in June of 2010 and was made of members representing consumers, family members, advocacy organization, advocates, service providers, local government, with administration and policy responsibilities for these services, state legislators, and academic programs conducting research and preparing behavioral health professionals. The advisory task force produced a report outlining its broader recommendations for services to clients in the public behavioral health system, and this report was made available to the legislature in December of 2010. The specific sections of this bill modify existing statutes in response to these recommendations of the task force. And of the sections, sections 4, 14, and 15 relate to implementing recommendations of the advisory task force relating to crisis intervention services for persons with mental illness. The changes expand the definition of health officer to include mental health professionals who work on mobile crisis teams and requires mobile crisis teams to coordinate their services with other emergency services, allow teams to operate within hospital emergency rooms, and requires teams to consider client preferences in completing crisis assessments. There are additional sections of this bill, sections 5 through 9, that relate to legislative direction that was set in 2009. When the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services instructed the department to improve the integrity of the state's rate-setting methodology for chemical dependency treatment rates. The legislation required the commissioner to, with broad-based stakeholder input, including proposed legislation for new rate methodology for the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. The new rate methodology must replace county negotiated rates with a uniform statewide methodology that must include a graduated reimbursement scale based on the patient's level of acuity and complexity. This report, again, was made available to the legislature earlier this session, and the sections 9 through 5 through 9 are the proposed legislative changes that are needed to implement that new methodology. Section 11, under Section 11, presently the department sets the Minnesota Healthcare Program rates for assertive community treatment teams and intensive residential treatment services based on provider estimated costs and utilization estimates, followed by a cost-based settle-up process at the end of the calendar year. The settle-up process has been determined to be cumbersome and is often difficult for providers when it results in the return of large sums of money from the provider back to the department. In response to provider desires for a less cumbersome rate-setting approach, the 2009 legislature directed the department to develop a more acceptable methodology and to ensure that this was done, a provision was placed in Minnesota Statutes 256B, which sunsets key provisions of the current rate-setting methodology on December 31st, 2011. With the adoption of the proposed language in this section, these sections, the department will streamline the rate-setting process while retaining its cost-based nature. The new system will set annual prospective rates based on the actual reported costs and utilization from the previous year and will do away with the annual settle-up feature. Then in Section 20, this section addresses a gap in the existing mental health services system for transitioned aged youth, ages 16 through 21, whose services needs are too severe for usual community-based mental health treatment, but are not intensive enough to need costly and restrictive inpatient hospital admission. This proposed language is budget neutral and updates the service model and rate-setting methodology for youth ages 16 to 21 with severe mental illness to align provider incentives and administrative roles to improve program effectiveness. And with that, that's a broad overview of the bill. I've got staff available to do a section by section if that's how you choose to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Root. Before we do that, I would like to just ask you to, I think in your overview, you mentioned that there were some sections of this bill that were that are being done to implement changes in federal rules or federal law. Could you just point those out again?
I think what you're referring to, Mr. Chair, is sections 5 through 9, and it is a response to a request by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to implement a uniform rate-setting methodology across the state for chemical dependency treatment rates. There was a report that was issued to the legislature earlier this session that established how that rate-setting methodology would look, and this is the implementing legislation.
Thank you. And just on that section, I'm just looking perhaps for some comment from the department. And we had, I think, similar things that were presented earlier this morning in our committee. And I just wanted to get from you if the department is, I understand we're complying with federal law. I understand that. But setting that aside, are these provisions, these changes, the right ones? Are they good? And if so, why have we not done this previously? I'm just trying to understand what the relationship is if the department is doing things simply because we're being asked to by federal law, or if there are good reasons to do them. And I'm just trying to understand what this dance we do with the federal government on compliance looks like.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to request that Gene Anderson from the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division join me at the table. While he's doing that, the existing chemical dependency treatment rates methodology was set in the late 1980s. It was a county-based administrated system, and it is, as a result, there was a lack of uniformity for payment of similar services across the state of Minnesota, and many times within the same county. So this language sets a uniform methodology for the state so that a person who receives services in Stearns County, for instance, the payment for those services, if they're provided within a different county, would be precisely the same.
And I appreciate the explanation, and I'm not saying that isn't reasonable. I'm just curious why we never thought of doing that before now.
Mr. Chair, I'm Gene Anderson. I'm a supervisor in the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services Division.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
It has been considered, but hasn't been given weight to initiate until this time. I think what's happened over the years is the rates have been, as Mr. Reuter reported, have been growing kind of homogeneously in terms of one city may have two services that have different rates, anywhere from $20 to $150 an hour for the exact same hour of services. It hasn't been, I've been with the department a shorter period of time, but I know that this has been one of the confounding areas for a lot of counties, a lot of providers, and also for the department.
Well, and I appreciate your comment, and Senator Higgins, I'll turn let you ask your question in a minute. I'm just, I guess, a little concerned about whether the department is acting as an administrative unit of federal government policy on these issues, or if we are making independent assessments of what is right for Minnesota and doing those things, and then on the occasions when we have to, I understand we have to comply with the federal law, but I'm just trying to understand how that's functioning, I guess, and have we become over time primarily a administrator of federal rules rather than making determinations about what is right in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important, and Mr. Anderson can follow up with this, that for the committee to understand that this new rate-setting methodology was there was a significant number of stakeholder meetings that took place for with stakeholders from the state of Minnesota to identify the best rate-setting methodology that should exist across the state.
Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Anderson or whoever's the right person,
Mr. Reuter?
Do people, I assume we'll end up with a number somewhere in the middle between the lowest rate and the highest rate. And does that have a significant cost or savings to our budget, or does it just all kind of come out in the wash? Do you have any sense of that yet?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, yes. Our legislation directed us from 2009 to initiate this process that would become budget neutral to the amount that we spent in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund as of January 1st of 2009. We did a couple of different activities around this. One was surveying providers to see what they were actually spending on types of service and types of personnel and types of space. We did some just cost averaging, trying to find what the mean rate was. And what we found is that there actually is a fairly close comparison to what the rates are when we looked at an independent modeling process to develop the method and then just averaging what the rates were on January 1st of 2009. So in the process, there are some rates that are going to come up for folks that have been artificially held below even average because they established a low contract 20 years ago, and there's going to be some rates that will be coming down because maybe they initiated their contracts in the last 5 years or 10 years, and we're able to initiate a higher rate than anybody that could change their rate from the past 25 years.
So,
Senator Higgins.
I was wondering whether it was an action on our part that made the discrepancies in the rates, but it sounds like it's a contractual thing that the providers themselves did. Do I understand that correctly?
That's
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, that's correct. The rate setting was left by law, by rulemaking or statute to be left to the host county or tribe as the placing authorities.
Thank you. Well, Senator Newman, you'd indicated to perhaps have a kind of review section by section. Is that your intent?
At least, perhaps we could do this. Is that if I could go through the bill, I've outlined a number of questions that I have that I could put to the testifiers and have them address it, and then maybe if the committee, you know, wants to go through it section by section, other than that, we could certainly do so. But I have read the bill, and I do have some questions. And the first one, Mr. Chairman and members, would be on page 5, section 7, which deals with vendor eligibility. And specifically what this section says is that if folks don't meet the requirements of subdivisions 1A and 1B, they are not eligible vendors. And then 1A and 1B goes on and makes quite a lengthy list of new, what appears to me anyhow, to be new requirements in order to be a eligible vendors. And it goes from line 5.22 down to line 6.27. And I guess I would request the department to explain, you know, why we have such, at least what appear to be, quite a laundry list of new requirements in order to be an eligible vendor.
Mr. Anderson, is that yes, in your jurisdiction?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman. What you'll find is in line 522 through the area mentioned, line 627, are the actual requirements that we had to put into the statute language, as these are items that we need to have in our provider agreements and addendums with each of the providers. Currently, the counties would contract with the providers and place this type of language in there for all kinds of requirements that they'd have the provider follow. When we initiated the process of drawing up our own addendums and contract language, these are items that, especially for the room and board areas, were not mentioned in current statute or rule. So we needed to have them included in the statute here today to be the authorizing language for us to put those into the requirements that we have with each of the providers. Most of these are actually items that mirror what happens for regular treatment currently out of Rule 31 for treatment providers.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up question. Then, Mr. Anderson, it sounds like these are requirements for agreements or contracts. And if that is correct, then why do we have to have them placed in statute?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, because we don't have authority to require some of these things out of the new providers that are going to be paid, like the room and board providers, we don't have authority anywhere else to require that of those providers. Additionally, in the amendment language, one of the additional items that was added was requiring insurance of the provider so that they had a liability and anti-theft insurance, and that language was something that's held in all of the county contracts with providers. But now that the state will be the contract holder, we needed to have a place that would authorize us to require that insurance.
So, and just so I'm clear, Mr. Anderson, so in the course of creating this uniform system across the state, whereas before these were all dealt with on a county basis and led to some variation in rates and other things and variation in contract structure, to accommodate all those different things, we've had to say, well, let's look at all these structures and make sure we've got things in our statute that allow us to do those things that are currently being done. Is that correct?
Correct. And Mr. Chair, in the language of treatment based on level of acuity and complexity that we were required to accomplish through the rate methodology required us to establish what levels of acuity and complexities would be addressed in the methodology. In other words, previous to this, treatment was treatment and did not have in the past 2 years especially items for different types of levels of intensity for residential care, individual counseling, co-occurring care, So it was all, you paid for treatment, and it was all lumped under that same category. This way we can identify and pay specifically per level of care that a client receives and what type of facility they receive that from.
Thank you. Senator Newman, did you have?
Next, Mr. Chairman, if we could go to page 7. We've got, beginning on line 7.32, eligible chemical dependency treatments include, and then there is a beginning there and down to maybe page 8.28, there's a list of various eligible treatment services, and they're all referenced by rule. And I, if Mr. Anderson could comment on, you know, just, you know, there's a lot of rules there referenced, and I haven't looked up all those rules, and if he could just explain if this is all new eligibility treatment services or if they are already existing, why are they listed here?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, many of those items that are in the language currently that are presented before you talk about levels of care again that have been out of place in the language for treatment for the past 3 years. Additionally, as we set up the rate methodology, we need to have a justification for what would be a payment method for certain levels of service, for example, co-occurring or the client that has mental illness and chemical dependency. If you look at line 8.29, one of the items that through the work group process and our consultant, we identified we can demonstrate that there's a higher cost for treating a co-occurring client because of the need for co-occurring staff, which would be more expensive. Line 8.29 identifies in that line the percent of staff that has to be at least mental health professionals, which would be a new cost for treatment providers. Many of the other rules that are listed and referenced have to do with either current Rule 31, which is the 95.30.600, through the other division or the other items that talk about client safety and having vulnerable adult reporting mechanisms.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, the next question that I have would be on page 9, section 8. It looks to me like there's a rate methodology section, and a report was to be presented to the legislature in 2011. I guess I'd like to know what that report said or you know, what its recommendations were. And then secondly, we now have a situation apparently where the commissioner will have the sole responsibility for setting this rate methodology, whereas before this bill or this statute has been amended, there would have been broad-based stakeholder input, and that's being eliminated. And I'd simply like the department to comment on those two aspects.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, it is correct that we established the methodology at this time based on broad-based stakeholder input, and that is the rationale for our inclusion of lines 9.13 through 9.15 is to continue to gather information from the providers so we have a more of a cost-based process for establishing those rates.
Mr. Anderson, before we leave that section, the current statute says that you have to develop a recommendation and present a report to this year's legislature. Is that going to be set aside, or have you already completed that report, or what's the status of the current requirement?
That report was delivered to the Legislative Library and the Chairs of Health and Human Services on the 4th of March, and that report recommends the information that's in here, and the language that we have before us is actually the enabling language for that methodology to be implemented.
All right. Senator Newman?
Then, Mr. Chair, page 10, lines 14, 15, and 16 appears to me to enable the commissioner to transfer funds from one program to another. I would ask the department to comment on that. It would appear to me to be new language authorizing that transfer, and I guess I would like to inquire as to what that's all about.
And Senator Newman, before we take that up, in the amendment that we adopted, the A2, that section, lines 14 to 16, was deleted and replaced with some other language that is similar, although a little bit different than what you see in the main text of the bill. I think your question is still pertinent, but I just think it's a little bit different language.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the A2 amendment, line
1.22 to 1.26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Rudin.
The reason that this language is in the amendment is that when we were moving this through the executive branch, the Minnesota Management and Budget Office had some concerns about the language that's in the bill on lines 10.14 and 10.16. So we came up with the amendment language, which they felt more comfortable with. Our feeling was that this language actually better belongs in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Appropriation Bill rather than the policy bill. However, with the amendment, the Minnesota Management and Budget felt that this could proceed within the policy bill.
And so the amended language that we adopted in A2 says that any unused funds from the inpatient child and adolescent behavioral health service hospital operated by state operated services under section, et cetera, the money can be transferred to children's mental health grants. Is that essentially what we're saying? Are there unused funds, or is there an expectation there would be?
Mr. Chair, there are not unused funds. This is allowing for a similar option, and this was also a recommendation of the Chemical and Mental Health Advisory Task Force that is moving forward. This mirrors language that exists in the adult mental health world. Where when we were closing regional treatment centers, we were able to take funds out of the regional treatment centers and move them into adult mental health grants. I have Gary Cox with me from the Children's Mental Health Division that can provide additional insight into this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Cox, and I'm with the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. As Mr. Reuter stated, this is authority that exists for adults at this point, and the task force that he refers to felt that it was necessary to allow the same sort of transfers on the children's side, and the reason is relatively simple. And the Wilmer facility is able to treat children and adolescents in the Wilmer area, or people who are willing to transfer their children, you know, put their children in a facility very far away, but there's a lack of inpatient adolescent hospital beds across the state. And what this allows the department to do is take funds that may in the future be unused at the Wilmer facility, contract with community inpatient hospitals throughout the rest of the state, and make these inpatient psychiatric services available to children closer to their home in their own communities.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, how do you decide that some money is unused? How do you know you're not going to be needing to use it next week?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, this is done by it's the budget projections against the the current or the projected bed uses against the appropriated budget for the that division of the state operated services. They establish a budget at the beginning of the or before the beginning of the fiscal year, monitor the usage of the facility, the beds, the all the other costs that go into providing inpatient services. And at some point, they're able to make projections forward that because our a certain percentage of our beds are being unused, we're not going to need X number of dollars for the rest of the fiscal year. So the intent would be, once that determination is made, to transfer those funds within the same fiscal year to the Children's Mental Health Division for contract beds.
And then, Mr. Chair, just to follow
Senator
up,
Higgins.
At what point in the fiscal year do you make that decision?
Mr. Cox.
I'm Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins. I'm not sure that there's a set point in time. I think it's whenever the state operated services is able to make that determination. And I think I would guess in this, I'm not the budget person for state operated services, but I believe that they probably would have a pretty good idea going into the fiscal year just based on past usage of the beds at the Wilmer facility.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I thought we never or almost never had unused beds for adolescents. I'm just really confused about that. I mean, we've had so many conversations in this committee about the sure. need for more adolescent beds. I think we gave approval to add on to Prairie St. Hoositz, whoever that is, and expand the number of beds we have, and now here we're somehow making a determination that beds aren't necessary, aren't going to be used, and so we're going to move them someplace else. And I mean, maybe
Mr.
there are some ad.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins,
Mr. Ruger.
This provides for the option if there are additional funds that are unspent. We know right now today that there are not unused funds that will be available. We also know that that there is a budget proposal in the omnibus budget bill that actually affects this legislation that would move, close the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Wilmer and relocate the child and adolescent program that we're talking about in this legislation to the Wilmer Community Behavioral Health Hospital site, and that by doing so, there are budget savings that are within the existing omnibus bill. So our position is right now, from state operated services perspective, is that there are not unused funds that would be available to do this.
So this is just a precaution, Senator Higgins. Mr. Chair, just in case sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, yeah, I think that's if those funds should become available, this would allow the state to a more flexible use of the state resources to provide inpatient psychiatric services closer to where the children are. The shortages that we experience they're all over the state. But you know, if they don't happen to be, if the children who have the need this year don't live anywhere in the treatment area of the Wilmer facility, they very well may live in other communities where there is a shortage, and then the state resource could be moved to those areas where the need is.
Could I just ask, if this language were not in the bill and there were unused funds, what would happen to those unused funds?
Mr. At Ruger? The end of the biennium, they would cancel and be go back to the general fund or whatever happens to cancel unused funds.
Then you better keep them.
Thank you. And Ms. Aberholden is looking to make a comment. I wanted to make sure she had an opportunity to speak to this issue. I know she's had an interest in this, and so
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Contract beds are a little different than just simply a hospital bed, and I think that's an important distinction to make. So the CABS program, Children and Adolescent Program in Willmar, has never been full. And part of the problem is where it's located. Part of the problem is because where it's located, you can't find some of the professional staff that you need to be there. But a lot of the children who go there have been in inpatient, often in the metro area, but they need an extended stay. And so what the contract beds and this money would do was allow them to have an extended stay, which would actually keep them closer to their families. We already do that on the adult side. And so when the group looked at this summer, we said, you know, that really made a lot of sense to do that because you keep people closer to their home communities and, you know, you're able to keep them in those where they are instead of moving them, for example, all the way to Willmar.
I see.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I've listened very carefully to all of this discussion, and I will tell you that I'm candidly not comfortable at all with an authorization of, you know, enabling the movement of unused funds. I simply do not agree. And there may be good reasons for it, but I believe that the department should come back to the legislature and ask for that. So, with that comment, Mr. Chairman, on the A2 amendment, I'm going to move to delete lines 1.22 through 1.26.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, I think what would possibly be cleaner is just to delete on page 10 of the bill, subdivision 2, and that's what the amendment amends, and if it's gone, then there's nothing to amend.
Senator Newman, are you tracking the suggestion is to have the amendment just delete subdivision 2 on page 10, which would, after the amendment which we have adopted, that language is incorporated as subdivision 2?
Mr. Chairman. Yes, I understand, and I will certainly accept whatever recommendation council has for me in order to get it in the right phrase correctly. Because I recognize it's now in the bill. I'm simply making reference to the lines I was able to identify.
Senator Newman has oral amendment to delete subdivision 2 on page 10.
Mr. Chairman. Wonder, Council, if we just deleted section 10, would that take care of it?
There's other changes made in subdivision 1, for example, on 10.12 and 10.13. And I'm not sure if the department needs that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Reuter.
Those changes in subdivision 1 are related to the changes in subdivision 2. So if you're deleting the changes in subdivision 2, we would not need the changes in subdivision 1.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Reuter. So I guess then the appropriate oral amendment would be to delete section 10.
And I will modify my amendment to that effect, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Higgins on that motion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I know it's taken us a while to work our way through what this meant, and yet I think that if we're doing this for the adult population, it makes sense to do this for the child and adolescent population. It certainly can't be something that the department is unfamiliar in doing, and it sounds like the amendment that, or the piece of the A2 amendment that related to this subdivision 2 was on the recommendation of MMB. So I think they probably thought of it as something that was not out of the norm to do. So I would suggest that we leave it in the bill and you know, let our professionals work with it and ask them to continue answering questions if we have them as we're working through it. But now that we've heard from several people and Ms. Abderholden from NAMI and other people. I'm comfortable with it being in there, especially because we found out that it was already being done for our adult population. So I guess that's speaking against the motion.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Senator
Newman. Senator Higgins, I appreciate your comments. I guess on this issue, we are simply going to have to respectfully disagree. And I would request the committee support my motion.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and whomever.
Mr. Reuter.
Mr. Reuter or someone with some expertise. When we authorized funds for one area, and if they were transferred to another, next budget cycle, what would that look like? Would we realize the transfer, or would the budget continue to reflect our original appropriation? I guess my point is budgets are statements of what we want accomplished, and if we are continually funding something and hearing bad things about it, and the money's being transferred somewhere else, we're not getting a true picture of what's happening. Whereas if the department comes back and requests a change in appropriation, we can get a better picture of what actions are actually being taken with the money.
Senator Benson, maybe our fiscal analyst, Mr. Albrecht, can you shed some light on this, and if the department wants to also respond, but Mr. Albrecht.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, the base for there is a rule for establishing bases, and it's set in statute. And unless the legislature says otherwise, it is the appropriation in the second year of the biennium. So a transfer of this nature would not affect the base of the original appropriation that the legislature intended.
So, Mr. Albrecht, so I understand. So if we had an appropriation to the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, and based on this language that we have in front of us, if there was unused funds and it got transferred to some other program, what we'd see in the budget activity is that the funds would all be used. And so then we would come back and restore the appropriation level to what it was before, even though not all the money was used. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It would show, regardless of what it was used for, it would show that it was all used.
And so, Senator Benson, to your point, I guess it would make it a little bit less clear that the monies that were appropriated for that program were not necessary because they were being diverted to some other program. But what we would see in the budget would be all the money used for that program was used up. And so it would send the signal that that was all needed for that program, even though it may have been transferred without really the awareness, I guess, of the legislature in this case. Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, I guess to the larger point, if, for example, the Wilmer program as designed is ineffective and not using the money well, if we transfer it, then that ineffectiveness would result in a potential decrease in funding in the future years and damage a program that might be very good. If we don't have clarity on good uses of our money, we'll be sending either we'll cut programs and do damage we don't know we're doing, or we send good money after bad. And I guess that's why I would support the amendment.
Before we act on the amendment and maybe other questions, but Mr. Reuter, do you know what the funding is for the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Service appropriation in the current biennium or in the forecast?
Mr. Chair, you're asking for the dollar amount?
Yes.
I do not know off the top of my head. That would be information that I would need to know, or if fiscal staff has the budget book, it would be in the budget book. Okay.
Okay. I don't think we have the budget books with us here this evening, so I'm assuming it's I don't know if you have a ballpark idea, but I'm trying to recall. I don't have a good recollection of what that is.
And I did not bring that information with me today.
All right.
That is information I could get to you, though, if you wish.
All right. Other questions on the motion? Senator Newman has offered oral amendment to delete Section 10, starting on page 9 of the bill. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Senator Newman.
In the last area that I would like committee to look at and have the department comment on would be Section 20. And I believe Section 20, which begins on page 18, is the new treatment modality language that is to deal with teenagers and young adults. And you will note that this is essentially 10 pages of new language, and I believe to be a new program. And so I think it would be appropriate for the department to walk us through it so that we can have some understanding of what in this new program entails.
Thank you. Senator Newman, I'm not sure who from the department would care. Mr. Cox, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. The Section 20 updates an existing medical assistance benefit. It's called the Assertive Community Treatment for Youth. It's in statute right now. What this language does is to update the clinical model, make it more appropriate for children. As you may know, when this benefit was first enacted, I believe it was in 2006, 2007. Prior to that, assertive community treatment had been an adult-only model. It's one of those evidence-based practices that's endorsed at the federal level, and it's used nationally. So what the legislature did in 2007 was to determine that the same model could be used for older adolescents. So we attempted at that time to adapt that adult-based model to children, and over the course of the last several delays for budgetary reasons, we've had a chance to take a look at the language and make it work better for children. So if Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can just walk you through and
please
show you what each section does. So under on page 18, under subdivision 2, the definitions, it simply tries to clarify the purpose of this existing benefit. And then beginning on the next page, on 19, it shows that there's later language to the same effect, but it expands the covered population from the current age 16 and 17 to ages 16 through 21. It would be budget neutral because those people, the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds are currently counted in the forecast for the adult assertive community treatment. So this would allow those children and their families to decide whether they wanted to go into a youth assertive community treatment program or an adult community treatment program. It also, on page 9 or at line 19.2, expands the benefit from mental illness only to include co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse disorders. I'm sure you've heard that in several other bills today. It's the way the world is going right now, with the co-occurring incidents. The rest of this section is definitions. All of these are to update the statute to current practice standards for adolescents. Unless there's questions on that, I can move to the next page. On page 20, it continues to be additional definitions. The one that may be of some interest is the one on line 20.1, the peer specialist, which would allow require these Youth Act teams to bring into their team a youth who must be at least 22 years old, but who has been a former consumer of either children's mental health services or adult mental health services, and serve as a peer mentor for kids that are just going into the treatment program. I believe the rest of it is fairly standard language. So we can turn, unless there's questions, we can go to page 21. Subdivision 3 is where the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds are actually added. And again, that would, because they're currently counted in the Adult Act forecast, it would be budget-neutral language. On line 21.19, the level of care determination is for the purposes of indicating that indicates the severity of the child or the adolescent's mental illness, and it simply says that a child has to be very severely mentally ill in order to qualify on these treatment teams. It's something that they, again, the purpose of the Youth Act is to try to. It's another level of service between the like outpatient services and the inpatient psychiatric commitment or residential treatment. The purpose of it is to avoid a child having to be placed in a residential treatment facility or inpatient care. Subdivision 3A on line 21.33, in that section clarifies that these ACT teams would be paid on a per diem basis. And
Mr. Cox, before you proceed, I just want to go back to line 21.16. When you're talking about the, first of all, the changes in ages, and you're saying that is budget neutral because it's just taking people who are already covered in one area and allowing them to be covered in another area. But does the inclusion of, or the definition on line 2.16 of co-occurring, does that broaden the scope of who is eligible, and would that bring additional people into the scope of what is covered and therefore have a budgetary impact?
Mr. Chairman, it would not bring additional people in, but it requires the treatment teams, the ACT treatment teams, to staff up and be capable of serving children, adolescents with co-occurring disorders. They can serve them now, but this requires them to be good at it, basically.
Does that require or anticipate some increase in cost that would have an impact on the budget?
Mr. Chairman, I would think probably it would be otherwise, because they're capable of serving children with co-occurring disorders, that would probably improve the outcomes of their treatment faster.
Thank you.
Let's see, on page 22, paragraph B identifies all the services that the treatment team would have to cover under this per diem. These are fairly standard mental health services. If you're familiar with the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, the Children's Rehabilitation Model, most of those services are in there, and it expands requires them to provide additional intensive services for this particularly ill population. And then in paragraph C at the bottom of that page at 22.35, it additionally ensures that the treatment team performs some other activities, like they need to be capable of providing crisis intervention. They need to be capable of completing an extended diagnostic assessment. And they need to complete the level of care determination. And then on page 23, subdivision 4, line 23.7. This section establishes the administration of the benefit is done by contract rather than certification. This we believe would make the administration of these ACT teams. We think that's going to be a much better way of administering these teams, doing it by contract, whether the contracts that can change over time as treatment modalities change, as mental health treatment progresses, rather than having to go back and amend certification standards from time to time. And then on line 23.18, subdivision 5 is where you find the definition of what is included in the treatment team. These are basically clinical standards. Okay. And then on the next page, it continues that same paragraph and defines the makeup of the team. It would say, for example, starting on line 24.7, the sort of the mandatory members of the core team, and then at 24.15, there's additional members that can be brought into the treatment team. It's called here in this language ad hoc client specific. These would be people who already are working with the child, such as, for example, if a child has a psychiatrist today and goes into the Youth Act treatment program, this would ask the treatment team with its own mental health professionals to consult with the child's existing psychiatrist. I think then we can turn to the next page, 25, line 25.17 simply requires that the treatment team would participate in the department's efforts to evaluate the Youth Act program. Again, we are very concerned about the treatment outcomes of the child and the efficient use of state resources, and we intend to evaluate these programs, and this requires the participation of those programs in the evaluation. At subdivision 6, 25.22, there's additional service standards identified there. Such as 25.31, it says that the initial functional assessment has to be completed within 10 days. At 25.34, it sets out the standards for an individual treatment plan that must be completed on each client. An individual treatment plan is standard practice at this point, but this just clarifies exactly what must be part of that treatment plan. And then on the next page, page 26, excuse me, starting at page line 26.16, this states that the treatment team is required to engage the child's family in their treatment. And this becomes particularly important once the child reaches age 18, when different data practices and data and privacy standards come into effect. I think we all know that your child doesn't stop becoming your child when he or she turns 18 years old, and most families are going to continue to be engaged in that child's care and that. Whether it's this treatment care or in that child's life for quite a few more years. And this requires the ACT team to engage that family in the treatment planning. And the bulk of the language addresses any concerns that might arise with regard to data practices and privacy with regard to adults. It basically copies language from the federal HIPAA laws that does in fact allow treatment teams to share certain information with parents. And the reason that's in there is that we have heard reports, and this is some anecdotal information, that some ACT teams will not provide any information to parents, even when the parents are requesting it, because they cite privacy reasons. So this clarifies that even HIPAA allows that to happen.
Well, Mr. Cox, and I'm glad you pointed that out. I was going to ask about that. Our state law prohibits parents from knowing the treatments and the medical information of their minor children without the child's consent. And it would seem to me that this provision would conflict with that. Now, I had a provision earlier this session that was going to change that, but I'm a little curious about, we do have a law that says that information can only be provided upon consent of the minor child, and it would seem that this would conflict with that. And I'm not clear on that. Maybe you could clarify.
Mr. Chairman, I would certainly be glad to talk to you and get the citation that you're looking at and ensure that that's not the case. But it's my understanding that the state law and federal HIPAA laws are consistent in almost all cases. And this doesn't give carte blanche authority to tell parents anything. But
but it does say that. 26.16, that the treatment team shall actively and assertively engage the client's family members by establishing communication on line 26.18 and collaboration and educating the family about the client's mental illness, symptom management. And then it does have an exclusion on lines 26.21 and 22 that says, with certain exceptions, it won't do that. But other than that, they must inform the family of the status of the illness and the treatment. And all I'm saying is that the state law prohibits that without the consent of the child. And I know that because we had a bill that was going to reverse that procedure. And so I'm just curious of why we can do that here when state law says you can't. And it would seem if we're going to do this, it would have to be notwithstanding that provision in law. But I would like clarification on that before we adopt this, frankly.
We can certainly get some clarification on that, and if you're willing to consider not.
Senate Council is maybe providing some clarification here. Ms. White.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that provision deals with medical procedures, whereas this deals with treatment. But that's something I'd need to look into, too, to make sure that that's the distinction between the two.
Well, Ms. White, I appreciate that. I'm not clear in my mind that there's a distinction between treatment and medical procedures, but I'm curious about this. And I guess before I would be comfortable in adopting this, I'd want some clarification of how this interacts with the law that I was seeking to change, frankly, with another bill. But
Mr. Chairman, I know the State Data Practices Act and as well as the federal HIPAA make distinctions between standards, privacy standards for mental health, there's distinctions between chemical health and mental health. There's distinctions between those two and physical health. So the standards are somewhat different. That may be the one that you're referring to. We certainly can clarify that.
And Senator Benson, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, does this bill go to judiciary because of this provision?
Senator Higgins, you know, I am I'm not aware that they have requested it. I suppose we could send it to them, but I don't believe
that would be their jurisdiction to figure out.
Well, I think that's correct, but that's why I'm not clear what the interaction of this is.
If I can go back to the last statement I've forgotten your name.
Gary Cox.
Mr. Cox said was that we have in state law different provisions for physical health, mental health, and chemical health. that may be the answer. I don't know. But if we can...
And it may be, Senator Higgins, that I guess the only reason I'm questioning that is that in the bill that I had that was going to try to reverse that presumption, as I understood it, it applied to mental health issues.
And so
that's why I'm questioning in this case why we can do that here and not otherwise. But I think there needs to be some clarification on that before I would be comfortable personally in adopting this provision.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
The bill that you are referring to was heard in Judiciary, and Mr. Chair, I believe your recollection is accurate.
Mm-hmm. That's what I recall.
That's what I remember. Well.
Mr. Chairman, I could offer this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I think, and you could use this language as a precedent for your...
Well, and Mr. Cox, I'm contemplating that. Believe me,
Well, okay, so the other option, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Where was it? Well, kind of 26.23 and that very long sentence there, where it looks like the client identifies a person who would be giving protected health information.
And
maybe we should add some language like that up in the minor piece.
In line 26.23, I believe that's because that the client is over 18.
Yes.
And then so there
yes.
It's permissive about they can designate. But the way that I read the current law with respect to medical issues, information, and treatment, that the blanket law is that can only be made known to family members with the consent of the minor. And if the minor doesn't consent, then it may not be done. And there's no way that family members can access it. And there's not even a provision. You can't even go to court and get it, as I understand the current law. And so I'm just curious about the provision here because there may be things that we're not understanding, I guess. I'm open to that. I'm not I don't claim to know how this all interacts. But I do think this presents some conflicts to what I understand the current law to be. Senator Higgins?
Well, Mr. Chair, on 26.17 and 18, we're striking the phrase after obtaining the recipient's permission.
And
that's the can of worms that is opening this whole, boy, that's a bad, well, you know what I mean. That's the part that is problematic. And maybe we need to just keep that in statute is, you know,
Mr.
you
Chairman.
Do have to get the recipient's permission.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman.
I would indicate that I frankly agree with the language that's in this bill, disagree with the law as it currently stands, therefore I would not support that kind of an amendment. I realize it's a bit of a conundrum for us, but in my view, it's absolutely appropriate if parents of a minor child have access to the medical records.
Well, and Senator Newman, I don't object to what the language in this bill is doing because I agree with you. I think that it's perfectly appropriate as I read this provision that what they're trying to do is establish some interaction with the family for the benefit of the child. And it may be that the child who is undergoing treatment may not wish to agree to do that. And so I don't disagree with the intent of the provision. It's just ironic, I guess, given.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I was trying to do is preemptively indicate to Senator Higgins that I would not be in favor of
current law.
I'm not in favor of current law.
We got to change it.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Cox,
if I could offer this. One further explanation. This isn't allowing for access to medical records, but it's allowing the parents and the treatment team to talk to each other about activities or information that would help support the child at that point in time in the treatment and particularly with regard to ways in which the family can help support the treatment and.
Well, and Mr. Cox, I don't disagree with the intent. I'm just reading the language. It says that they must educate the family about the illness and the symptom management. And that is a very, I mean, it's not saying they may or they could or that they have to get permission. It says they must do that regardless. And I, again, I don't disagree with that. But as I understand the current law, that activity is prohibited. And I maybe we should just pass it and then say, well, we've already done that over here. Why don't we go ahead and do it someplace else?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that Mr. Cox's distinction between medical records and communicating medical information, either one are going to be privileged. So I don't think that would be an accurate distinction.
Sarah Hoffman, were you?
No, I was just going to say what he said.
Okay. All right. Maybe we'll just leave that as it is for the time being, and perhaps it will be useful. I certainly don't disagree with the policy, and so I'm not trying to get rid of the policy. I think it's appropriate. I think it is the right thing to do. I just think it might be applicable in other circumstances as well.
Then if I may, Mr. Chairman, one question that I would have for Mr. Cox would be on page 24. We're talking about the core team being up beginning at line 24.5. And it indicates that the core team may include any of the following. And we've got listed additional mental health professionals, vocational specialists, educational specialists, child adolescent psychiatrist, mental health practitioner, mental health manager, housing access specialist. And my question, I guess, is twofold. Number one, are all of those individuals really and truly needed? And you know, I recognize that it's optional, but my question is, are they really needed in these instances? And number two, if you hire all of those people to work on mental health issues for a child or a young adult, does this bill really remain budget neutral? Who pays for all of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, I think the fact is that the per diem would remain the per diem. They would have to, if the team chose to hire any of these additional individuals, they would have to cover that within the payment that they were getting. They wouldn't get additional money to pay for these. And I think, you know, I wouldn't expect any team to ever hire the entire list, there may be with the particular client population in a particular community, there might be a need for a vocational specialist, for example. We just didn't, we wanted to give that, let that be an option to the team if they felt they needed it, if that was a big part of the issues that they were dealing with in their client population. If not, we wouldn't force them to hire those people. But the money doesn't change.
No, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cox, so I understand there. The respective members of the team, their piece of the pie just gets a little smaller given the more people that they hire. Is that essentially it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, yeah, I would expect that would be the case. Both the team itself is going to want to remain financially viable, and certainly the state as the contract managers are going to want to ensure that the team is financially viable. So we would be looking at that, those sorts of things as well as the rest of their business plan.
Mr. Chairman, that's Senator the extent Newman. Of the questions that I have regarding Section 20.
Thank you. One other question. I want to go back to Section 7 on page 5 briefly. And this was a section that talks about what is required to be an eligible vendor for treatment services, I think. Is that correct? And I just have a question out of curiosity, and I'm not sure what the technical term for the program, but I know a couple of years ago we implemented, I think, what are called wet house structures where people are allowed to participate and And is that governed by the same eligibility rules that are here, or is that something completely separate? And maybe you can clarify for that. I see Mr. Anderson is here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we do not govern nor pay for wet houses. That's not under the purview of the Department of Human Services okay. Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund at all.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a whole string of them, so here we go. Okay. Some of which have some substance and some of which are just more curiosity, if you will. On page 2, and I apologize if you've addressed any of this and I missed it, line 2.11, we've changed from 180 days to 3 years. That's a significant change. Why?
Mr. Reuter.
Mr. Chair, we are talking about page 2, line 11.
Yes.
I'm going to call John Anderson, who's with the Adult Mental Health Division, to come and answer that question.
Mr. Anderson, the other Mr. Anderson.
My name is John Anderson. I'm a supervisor in the Adult Mental Health Division of DHS. Mr. Chair, should I answer the question?
Yes, please. Line 2.11, the stricken language, 180 days replaced with 3 years.
This was a standard that is being proposed. The 180-day standard sometimes ends up being a barrier to treatment for individuals. And so what will sometimes happen is you'll have an individual in an inpatient setting, state hospital or something like that, and they're not able to get into another lesser level of treatment because someone isn't there to do a diagnostic assessment. And so what this does is in those situations where a significant change in that person's circumstances has not occurred, that in other words, it's pretty much the same person who's had the same problems, and a determination is made that there really hasn't been a change, and therefore a new diagnostic assessment is not required. So this is to eliminate barriers to treatment.
Thank you. Do you know, have additional questions?
Yeah, on page 9, the new language on lines 13 through 15, every biennium have to review the financial information from the vendors. What kind of financial information is received that we review?
The other Mr. Anderson is coming back. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Nino, your question is in regards to the financial information. Currently what we use to arrive at the methodology for the rate methodology was a cost survey of each program. So what we would ask them to do is a similar type of abbreviated survey that would talk about the types of units that they bill for. And then the number of units that they use, and then the costs associated with staffing and square footage for those. We had more official language requiring, which was more specific towards. Currently, federal law requires an A-133 audit if a program receives more than $500,000 from the federal government. And so some of our programs would fit that, but most of our programs wouldn't. We thought it was too prescriptive to ask for them to do all programs to do that larger audit. So this one will be much more concise to what we need for the rate methodology.
Senator Nino.
And Mr. Chair, then since you're going to, and I don't have a problem with it, but since you're going to kind of a lower threshold here, what or who determines the financial information that you get? Is that something you just ask for and hope they give you, or is it spelled out in rule? What you told me you receive, where is that written down somewhere, or what determines that?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nino, that information is an actual format that we received from SAMHSA that we used through our consultant to retrieve the cost survey. We have not developed this current format because of the fact that I think our initial feedback was that it was too prescriptive in terms of the larger audit. So it would be a format based on what we used for our federal used from our federal consultant.
Serenino.
And then on line, or excuse me, page 16, the new language starting on line 18. It indicates getting some preferences from the recipient communicated verbally. And a question that popped to my mind is, what about a nonverbal communication? What if you had someone who communicated via ASL, or is that legally considered verbal communication? I just was wondering why verbal was put in there as opposed to other nonverbal forms.
And the other, Mr. Anderson.
John Anderson, once again. We tried to cover the gambit. We missed ASL. But if you notice that it goes on to say that there are written forms of communication that should be considered as well, like psychiatric, advanced psychiatric directives and crisis prevention plans, wellness recovery action plans.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I did see those, but a verbal communication is very informal, and the remainder of the section are all very formal documents, and I just was wondering if there was a reason for the specificity of you can have these certain formal types of communication, or you can just tell us, and you wanted that specifically, or if that was an oversight with, I mean, I could talk to you verbally, or I could lose my voice today and write you a note, and it's basically the same kind of informal communication. I was just wondering if that was intentional. And ASL is the one that jumped out at me, but then I started thinking there may be some other form. And I just, again, I don't have a problem. I just was wondering if there was a reason why you were not wanting to include some of those other informal, or in the case of ASL, their version of a verbal communication.
Senator Nino, maybe with counsel's advice and Mr. Anderson, if that word verbally were stricken and replaced with directly, would that be sufficient, and would that be more broad?
Mr. Chair, that would be fine from our point of view.
And Senate Counsel, Ms. White, would that be workable, do you think? Would that cover the cases that Senator Nino was raising if we just said that the recipient's preferences is communicated directly by the recipient?
Mr. Chair, yes, I think that would take care of your
concerns. Well, Mr. Chair, that possibility had occurred to me, but I don't want to start messing with people's language until I figure out what their purposes are. So if that's fine, I would make that motion.
Senator Nino moves oral amendment, line 16.18, striking the word verbally and replacing it with the word directly. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, may I add on to that motion to delete the colon on the next line? Because it's just kind of random and incorrect.
And Senator Higgins,
incorporate that.
Senator Nino incorporates that into his oral amendment. Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
And Mr. Chair, related to that, then on page 26, the section you were talking about, we have on line 18 where we talk about communication and collaboration with the family. And I wasn't sure if those were kind of related in the same question about communication, but maybe not. As I'm looking at this now, the communications with the family, not necessarily with the recipient. So
I thought you might be suggesting that we broaden that scope to cover all.
No, so I'll skip that question, Mr. Chair, and go on to my next note here. I have a note on page 19, and let me take a look here. Oh, my question here, page 19, line 17. We have a whole section of new language, but on line 17 we have an education specialist, and barring a definition somewhere else in statute or rule, we've got a fairly vague definition here, and again, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just wondering if that was intentionally vague. An individual with knowledge and experience working with youth regarding special education requirements and goals, et cetera. That could be someone with a special education master's degree, or it could be a parent of a child who's been involved with special education. As I read it, either one would qualify, and I didn't know if that was your intent.
Mr. Cox?
Mr. Chairman, Gary Cox again from DHS. Yes, that was intentionally vague. We were hoping that whoever was had been working with the child at the school, in some cases that's going to be a special education teacher or a case manager, or it could be a classroom teacher.
Sir, Nino.
Okay. And then on the next page, page 20, I've got notes all over this, so I've got to remind myself here. Well, the first one, down on page 20, lines 27, it's a numbers one and number two. We've got some, prior to that, starting on line 25, substance use disorders defined in the DSM, current edition. And my question was, where you've got the numbers one and numbers two there, you have alcohol or drug abuse on line 27, which is indicated by et cetera, and then on line 29, dependence on drug or alcohol, which is indicated by. My question was, do you really need that? Isn't that all defined in the DSM?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cox.
Senator, no, the DSM does not cover those.
Okay, so that was my question, if that was really necessary. Then my secondary question is, on line 27, it's indicated by harmful effects on a person's life and killing work, et cetera, what are those?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I would like, or this is, this regards the co-occurring disorders and the harmful effects of on a person's life of alcohol and drug abuse. I think maybe I'd like to turn that, give my colleagues and CD a chance to.
Can you repeat the,
Mr. Anderson? Senator Nino.
Certainly, yeah. My question was, line 27, alcohol and drug abuse, which is indicated by harmful effects on a person's life, including work, et cetera. My question was, what are harmful effects, if we're putting this into law?
Mr. Anderson, I guess the question is that some term of art that has been defined, or is it subjective and just?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Dino, I guess I'm not positive if that's defined already in other statute or not.
Ms. White, are you aware of any definition of harmful effects with respect to chemical use in the statutes?
Mr. Chair, I'm not, and my computer died, so I can't look it up.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Anderson.
I do believe in the chemical dependency assessment rule. It does describe some of the harmful effects in 9530. To my recollection, that's where it's defined.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, if I understood that correctly, it's defined in rule?
Mr. Anderson.
State rule?
Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Dinito, yes.
Okay, so then I would ask counsel, is it clear that this then would be referring back to that definition, assuming that's correct?
Ms. White?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, terms that are used in the statute, if the term isn't defined in statute, you can defer to rule. So if it is defined in rule, then it would apply here. And I can hop on her computer and find out.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so then we would just automatically default back to that definition was my question.
Correct.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, the next, number two, dependence on drugs and alcohol indicated by tolerance, withdrawal, inability, et cetera. I don't necessarily have a problem with this, but what is tolerance? Is that I understand if you're running around with a BAC of 0.29, that's one, and you're still walking around, that's one level of tolerance. But if you're at a 0.08 and showing no indications at all, that's a different level of tolerance. And I just wanted to ask about that.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dino. Tolerance is described as needing increased quantities of a chemical to receive the same effects, or the ability to ingest higher amounts of chemicals.
Just before we, I guess this whole section J, substance use disorders, and just so I'm clear here, you're talking about some things that are included in the DSM, and in addition to those things, these other two, which are not, is that correct, that alcohol or drug abuse, which is that not something that's found in the DSM?
Mr. Chair, it is described in DSM.
I guess that goes back to Senator Eno's earlier question. If that is defined in the DSM, why would we need to define it here?
Just to ask defined.
Mr. Chairman, I think probably we could just say as defined in the DSM, or what are the the appropriate citation. I think the purpose for putting it here is just clarity within the statute itself. But
well, and it may not do, and Mr. Cox, it may not do any harm to have this here. If the language in 20.25 and 26 says it's defined in the DSM, and to certainly know your questions, if that's where it's defined and these are just sort of explanatory statements related to that, it may not do any harm, although it may not be necessary either. So, and Ms. White.
And Mr. Chair and members, Andy was kind enough to let me use his computer, and I could not find any reference to harmful effects in the 9530 or anywhere in rule. So that is an issue I need to research a little bit further.
Well, and I appreciate that. I guess I'm just going back to if the controlling clause is on 20.25 that says it's defined, and if that's what this is referring to, and I guess I would take the statements on numbers 1 and 2 under that to be more just explanatory. I don't know if they have a precise meaning. I guess I wouldn't know that I would expect that if that's the case. Senator Hoffman, were you going to ask a question?
No.
Oh, I thought you were signaling me.
No.
Senator Eno, did
you? Just a couple more, I think.
Did you want
to?
Senator Benson?
If we don't need them, I'd like to propose an oral amendment to remove on page 20, lines 27 through 30.
To remove that, those clarifying statements?
And Mr. Chair and members, you might want to also delete on page 20.26, comma, that include.
That include. Clean that up.
Oh, so you're getting rid of all of
them. And just leave it as the DSM.
Okay. Senator Benson moves as a oral amendment deleting on line 20.26 the comma, that include, colon, and then deleting lines 20.27 to 20.30 up to, but not including the period. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two real quick questions then on this page. I see on my other chicken scratch, and I realize what I was wondering about now. Up at the top of the page, 20.1 and 20.2, a certified peer specialist a peer specialist means an employed team member who's a certified peer specialist. I'm assuming that that is somewhere defined in law, that that's a certification. Oh, okay. And then on line 20.17, I just had a question. Well, it starts in 1.6. We've got some. This is a string of items here, but this is one of them. A former consumer of child and adolescent mental health services, or a former or current consumer of adult mental health services. And my question was, being a current consumer, and is that potentially problematic or not here? These were, I believe, for some, was this peer?
So Sorry, no, if I'm understanding.
I think you get my question.
It's defining what peer specialist. It has a certain meaning, but it also then lists a number of criteria in addition to which that they have to be a former or a current consumer of mental health services.
And my question was just around current. If I'm currently receiving treatment an adult for adult mental health, I just was wondering about that, if I'm going to be a peer counselor or whatever the title is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neal, this
Mr. Cox.
excuse me. excuse me. As you probably know, there are many mental health or mental illnesses that don't really go away. I mean, you can have them. You're going to have them for your life, and the goal is to treat those and ensure that they're under control, that you're a person is still functioning adequately in life. They've, in a sense, from a functional point of view, recovered from their mental illness, but they continue to consult with the psychiatrist from time to time, checking in just to make sure everything is okay. And so that's the purpose of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask. And then I believe my last question, on bottom of page 21, we have line 33, required service components subject to federal approval. Is this some sort of waiver, or what do we have? What does that mean?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is this section would be required. We'd have to get federal approval for this. This would be part of the state Medicaid plan. It would require an amendment. We don't foresee that would be an issue in this case, but we've learned from past experience that we'd better say that this doesn't go into effect until the feds say it's okay.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry, Higgins.
On that question, does this have a cost to us then if we're adding something to medical assistance? Something more we'll pay for?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I'm not sure.
I'm sorry.
What cost would we be adding?
Well, if you're saying that medical assistance is covering all these health services and supports under a single daily rate. Oh, that's the point that I'm missing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not anything new we're adding to
Correct.
It. It's just saying it's one rate.
Correct.
And that's what happens when it's tired out. Thank you.
I think Senator Nina has exhausted his notes.
And I'm just exhausted.
Are there other questions on the bill? Senator Newman? Other questions from the author?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I have none. I don't know if the members have any further.
I'm beginning to think that this, as the hour grows later, the committee is acting more and more like the Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. as I recall the way the Judiciary Committee operates.
Senator Hoffman.
Is Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
It's her influence on the committee. Yes. I know Senator Higgins was a member of the Judiciary Committee in the past, as was I, and you are currently. So maybe we ought to get about the business and move the bill before we find more things to correct.
Now, Mr. Chair, I'm prepared to unless any committee members have any objections, I'm prepared to move that this matter be passed out of the committee and onto the floor. The only question I have is the issues that you were raising on page 26. You had indicated some discomfort about moving this bill forward with that language in the bill. So I'm kind of looking for a little guidance from you. I believe that this is going to have to go to conference committee anyhow. So.
Well, and Senator Newman, I guess I agree with the policy in the bill that it's describing.
As do I.
And so I'm not sure I'd want to have it go to Judiciary Committee and have it get stricken out because it might be useful. But Senator Higgins, that you were...
Mr. Chair, we probably should ask if there's anybody in the audience who wants to give us any
Absolutely.
Words of wisdom.
Absolutely. We'll do that before we take take a vote. But so, Senator Newman, to your question, I'm not... Judiciary has not requested the bill. I think if we sent it there, it might never return. And if the idea is to get the bill passed, we may not want to do that unless we have to. I wouldn't recommend it, but it's your bill.
Then my motion, Mr. Chairman, is to move the bill to the floor.
Before we do that, to Senator Higgins' point, I would like to invite, if there's anybody in the audience here that would like to make any comments on the bill before we move it. Yes.
I'm Dr. Tricia Stark with the Minnesota Psychological Association. Mr. Chair, this may not make a difference at all, but the lines you deleted, if it just reads substance use disorders, that would include things like...
refer back to the page that we're doing that. I can't...
Page 20, line 25, I think.
Yes.
These reference the lines that were deleted reference alcohol and drug abuse.
Yes.
If it's just based on the DSM-4, it would include things like caffeine addiction and nicotine addiction. And probably that makes no difference in terms of an ACT team, but...
Well, and I appreciate that there's probably more things in the DSM that are substance use disorders. I guess, going back to the previous discussion, those lines that were deleted seem to be clarifying. It says we're going to rely on the definition in the DSM that include these things. So it doesn't mean that other things are not included, but just as included. So sort of highlighting those as pertinent points. And I guess I don't have personally any objection to the clarifying language, but I would accept the point that the committee made that it's probably not necessary that they be included in the bill. But
so it's not exclusive to those two.
It doesn't direct a focus on those. It doesn't limit in any way. It just highlights.
And Mr. Chair.
Sir Higgins.
The doctor's using her iPad to go through that. And I'm so jealous looking at it. And she's making the words larger and smaller and moving things around. And it's fascinating, and we should all have them.
Senator Higgins, I agree. We should have a committee budget that provides us all with such things. But Dr. Stark, did you have another comment to make?
If the department and if the committee don't see it as a problem, I just don't want you to be accused of allowing people to be treated for caffeine addiction or something like that. So,
and I'm assuming that the department would agree. My reading of this is that wouldn't be included. I think there was some language earlier that sort of excluded those things. In fact, I recall seeing something about on line 19.11, substance use disorders include alcohol or drug abuse or dependence, excluding nicotine use.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we would agree.
Mr. Albrecht, did you have a question that you... Mr. Albrecht is just asking the question if that amendment that we adopted made the population larger and therefore have a cost associated with it.
The amendment...
Which amendment are we talking about?
The one we're talking about, I assume.
On page 20?
Yeah.
Oh, let's see.
The deletion language on lines 20.27 to 20.30.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Cox.
I don't believe that would make a difference in the population. As earlier in section 20, it describes how in order to get into an ACT team, there has to be a level of care determined for the child that requiring intensive need for mental health services due to a severe mental illness. So this is this striking this language isn't going to make any difference to that whatsoever.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Newman, you have a motion, I believe, before us. Is that correct?
Yeah, my motion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My motion is that this will be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor.
Senator Newman recommends that Senate File 1285 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Newman. Thank you, members of the department. We appreciate your patience with us in our attempt to be the Judiciary Committee. Members, we are meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock after session, assuming we get done with session at 1 o'clock, and it will be relatively short compared to today. I think we have three bills now, given the one that we had earlier today that we are going to carry over till tomorrow. And I, Senator Higgins, I hope that you've had a chance to, or will have a chance before then, to talk with the department about the language issues from the previous bill, so that if it comes back tomorrow, we'll have some resolution to that.
I hope so, too.
All right. And thank you, members, for your patience, and I know it is late, so appreciate it. We are adjourned.